Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. What do you know about Arab Americans? What do you know about Arabs? What do you know about the Arab world? And where do you learn it? How do you know it's accurate? Joining the program today is James Zogby. He is on a 12-city tour to promote his new book, Arab Voices, What They're Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Jim is founder and president of the Arab American Institute. He travels widely to speak on the topic around the world and today in Columbus. He is speaking at the Columbus Council on World Affairs today. The event is sold out, but video of his talk will be posted on the council's website, and we will, of course, post that link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you.
I thought we could just kick off with a pretty famous now remark by Juan Williams on Fox News.
When I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
I bring that up because it's probably the latest, best, most famous example of what? Of a misperception, of ignorance, of what is it?
Both. I think both. But, you know, Politico asked me to comment on that and do a little writing.
I bet you did a little comment.
Instead of actually writing something in full, I simply took Juan's words exactly as they were, and I said, what if he had said, and I took out, go into a plane, I said, go into a store, and put Jewish instead of Arab or Muslim. And then I did the same thing, and I said, walking down the street at night, and I took out, again, Muslim, and I put in black, young black. And I said, how would that sound to you? And if it sounds awful, if it makes you wince, then it was wrong to do. I'm not going to comment on what NPR did. That was their business, and they dealt with it.
Another topic.
But what Juan said was profoundly disturbing to me and should be to everybody, because it indicated a level of prejudice that has become acceptable, because the defense of Juan afterwards by Fox and by so many others said to me that they've taken bigotry and prejudice and fear of Muslims, made it not only acceptable but something to be defended, and it was troubling.
You bring up the fact early on in the book, I think in the introduction, that this is that the whole 9/11 actually has a precursor in recent times, and that would of course be the bombing of the Oklahoma City, the federal building in Oklahoma City. Obviously, Muslims didn't have anything to do with that, but at first, or for a brief moment, brief and dull moment.
It was a couple day nightmare. Mm-hmm. And I was actually doing my weekly television show the night of the event. And I was getting phone calls. It's a live call-in show like this. And we were getting calls from folks down in Oklahoma City, house surrounded by people chanting, demonstrating against them. People had stones thrown at them. There was this young man who was arrested, held for days, interrogated before they finally realized he had nothing to do with it at all. There was a spike in hate crimes that occurred across the country, actually, right after that.
And even though they obviously it had nothing to do with anybody who was Arab, mm-hmm. or Arab sympathizer, it had nothing to do with anything like that, it hung on.
It hung on because we've had a campaign going back to actually the early 70s of equating Palestinian and Arab with terrorist. I did a paper back in the early 80s called The Other Anti-Semitism. What I did was I traced cartoons about Arabs and Muslims at that time with cartoons of Jews in pre-Nazi Germany and Tsarist Russia. In content and in form, they were identical. Actually, the two anti-Semitisms, the ones against Jews and the ones against Arabs, are very similar and spring out of some of the very, very same kinds of fears, a threat to our civilization. At the time in the pre-Nazi Germany, you know, Jews were more violent. They were irrational. They were trying to destroy our civilization. They were using their money, our money, to destroy us. There was the picture of the Jewish anarchist subversive terrorist. They burned the Reichstag. They were behind all of labor unrest in America. When there were riots in the streets in America, it was the Jews were somehow doing it. All of that was part of the culture, and it was simply translated into and imposed upon Arabs and Muslims. They became the new boogeyman, and with some very disturbing consequences.
And one of those being ultimately that the most violent and damaging attack on the United States, on United States soil, did occur. It was made by
There isn't a connection in the sense that what caused those 19 young men to do what they did was sheer hatred. And it was an act that finds no justification in anything. I am not one who will find a but or an excuse for terrorism. But it's the reaction to the terrorism that is the something that we had experienced before. And as unwarranted as it was for us to get death threats after the Oklahoma City bombing or in random instances of violence that had nothing to do with Arabs, it was that unwarranted again for us to get death threats after 9/11. My life was threatened on three separate occasions. Three men went to jail for threatening my life or my family after 9/11. It was unwarranted. I had nothing to do with it. To generalize guilt, to use prejudice instead of reason is something that has, as I say, consequences. And the consequences fall on the innocents. And in that case, it was me. It was people in my community. It was those who were of the Sikh faith, have nothing to do with Arabs, Muslims, anything. Three men who were Sikh gas station owners were shot to death because the perpetrators were wanting to teach Arabs a lesson. Just wrong. Prejudice is dangerous, and as I say, people suffer because of it.
My guest is James Zogby. He is speaking at the Columbus Council on World Affairs today. The event is sold out. You can see a link to it, however, on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, we're talking about his new book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. If you have a question or comment for Jim, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And I'm going to ask Jim to sit a little bit more forward so people can hear him very, very well. Andrew, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much. I really enjoy your show. It's something that I try to get to every day. I really enjoyed what he said about reason. My kind of comment, sort of maybe even question for the audience, when the incidents of 9/11 happened, actually, the first thing that I did was try to use reason and try to understand more. I think that, you know, what I wanted to do was pick up a Quran. I felt that it was Muslim-based. I understand it's not necessarily all Arabs or are Muslim. I know that there's Christian Arabs and all different types of religions, but I feel like a big problem with this is lack of educational choice, like choosing to be educated about it and trying to find out instead of just saying, well, this is this race doing that. And I feel like that happens in almost all racism. I think I've actually even seen something on Science.
You know, Andrew, let me stop you because, you know, it's interesting that the social organism, America, Americans, reacted in many ways after 9/11. One of them was those who struck out in hatred and rage. They, however, did not define the majority of the public, thank God. Most Americans responded with goodness, and many responded, as you suggested, with curiosity. What is going on? We actually got more questions at my office. Who are the Arabs? Everything from the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association to the Justice Department's Community Relations Service and the Department of Education contacted us to say, can you get us materials quickly about who are the Arabs and who are the Muslims? People want to know. And it was rather shocking to me that living in the world that we live in, as interconnected as we are, that we don't know as much as we ought to know, and we don't even have the materials to teach the kids as much as they wanted to know. People were asking all the right questions after 9/11. We didn't have the material to give it to them to provide them the answers. And so your reaction, I think, was a very important one and a very healthy one, and many Americans reacted that way. And it was really quite, important to recognize what that meant about our country and the goodness of our people. But we did not, I think, take advantage of that moment to educate ourselves as we should have.
Thanks, Andrew.
I also don't think that it was highlighted enough, the people that did. I feel like often in news, as I'm sure lots of people know, although I get a lot of my news from separate sources, but I feel like in a lot of major, you know, online or television news, those things aren't highlighted.
Sure.
It's the negative reactions, the people that do shoot gas station attendants that aren't are Sikh.
Let me give you another example. If you remember just a few months ago when we had that guy down in Florida going to burn a Quran, it was all the news. In Washington, I was part of a meeting that brought together the major leaders of the National Council of Churches, the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference, five major Jewish religious community group, the Orthodox, Reform, the Reconstructionist, the Conservative, etc., the Orthodox churches, the Black church leadership. It was an incredible collection of religious leadership. They spent 2.5 hours debating and then passing a resolution denouncing bigotry against Muslims. Went to a press conference. There were 100 reporters at the press conference. The next day it got almost no coverage because the entire news story was this guy in Florida who was going to burn a Quran. And so I think the media oftentimes fails to report the real news, instead focuses on the sensational. I mean, the loudest voice gets the most coverage, or the angriest or most outrageous act gets the headline treatment. And here we had every major religious leader in America taking a position on something, and yet the nut job in Florida got the headlines.
Andrew, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with James Zogby, author of Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. There's some very interesting data in here from their polling in the Arab world. Stay tuned. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU News Team.
Agencies that help the poor and people with disabilities are likely to see their state aid reduced. Nonprofits like food banks and social service groups often are the first places people turn.
It's maintaining the resources that they're giving us for food, not for our operations or anything else. This is about a lot of food that people would need.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
It's 12 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. A few snow flurries today and some sunshine, a high of 19 degrees, but with the wind chill, it'll feel as low as -5. Clouds tonight and a low right around 10 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU public media.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is James Zogby, pollster and author of Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I want to get to Jack because I want to talk about this. Jack, you want to talk about the need for more religious education in schools.
The history of religion.
Okay.
Mr. Zogby, nice to talk to you both this morning.
Thank you.
I'll just quickly say I work at a faith-based community center. I'm off work because they can't meet the payroll, and I'm not even a religious person, but I'm not an atheist. What I notice in this country most of all is, as a 78% based Christian country, there's very little study of the history of religions in the schools, and I think that should be separated. We should have the history of religions, of major religions, taught in the schools, at not just before, not getting to college, but kids who don't even go to college, and that we should have the faith-based centers teach religion. And I think this would allow for a lot more hands-across-the-water approach to how we react to other people, of other faiths, of other ethnic-based countries, how people react to each other. I think that's one of the biggest failings right now in this country is the lack of history. And I think Howard Zinn's book points that out, the People's History of the United States.
Yeah, I look, the fact is that we don't know who Arabs are, the 350 million people. We had at one point 180,000 troops in the middle of their lands. We've lost more lives in that region. We've fought more wars in that region, sent more money, sent more weapons, have more at stake in that region than any other part of the world. And yet we know almost nothing about it at all. When we did a poll of Americans, when First National Geographic did the poll in 2003, right before the start of the Iraq War, they found that 11% could find Iraq on the map. 3 years later, did the same poll, number jumped to about a third. When we did the same poll just last year, we found it was 37%. We lost 4,400 young men and women in a country where a little over a third of our people know where it is. That's shocking. And frankly, I you know, having done this work now for so many years, one of the things that was the most eye-opening to me was the TV show that I do, a weekly television show that is the live call-in program. 1 week before the war was about to start, we had students at Davidson College in North Carolina linked by satellite with students at the University of Baghdad. An incredible conversation took place for an hour and a half. And at the end of it, one of the Davidson kids said to me, "It's so hard to think that we just look them in the eye and a week from now we're going to be bombing them." I think you make different choices as a country if you know people, which is why I call the book Arab Voices and the importance of listening. If we listened to people, if we knew their history and heard them tell us their story, we would react very differently in the world. But if to the degree to which we can objectify and reduce them to less than human and see them as something just kind of to be erased from the landscape, then we can make some horrible mistakes, as we have over the last several decades.
Jack,
I think the Spanish Inquisition and what we're doing in America today brings into question, why is it that education is stifled in one of the most advanced countries in the world?
Well, you write about education quite a bit in the book and talk about not only our understanding of the Arab world, but just the language itself.
Well, less than 1% of American high school students study Arabic, and the number of students studying Arabic to reach proficiency, only 2,400. Now, here at Ohio State, you have a marvelous center for Middle East studies that not only educates the next generation of teachers, but also brings in current teachers every summer in a marvelous program that helps them understand the Middle East better, because the kids who are teaching right now don't know anything about that region and need to, because the kids that they're teaching are, maybe their parents are off fighting in the Arab world or will be soon fighting in the Arab world. I mean, we are engaged so heavily and we know so little that we need to take dramatic steps to overcome this burden. And I think that what's happening here at Ohio State is important as a model that ought to be replicated in so many other places around the country.
You referred to another example of how if we don't know much about them, it's easy to dissociate ourselves from them. When there was a conversation between Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, I think it was Leslie Stahl back in 1996,
sure.
And it was when we had a some kind of economic.
We were tightening sanctions against Iraq. And at one point, Leslie Stahl, in the questioning to Madeleine Albright, she said, "Reports are from the UN that about 500,000 children have died from the sanctions. Is it worth it?" And Madeleine Albright said it was worth it. And she has later regretted those comments. I know former Secretary Albright. I actually, when her book came out, I interviewed her around the country. She and I did a couple of places together and think very highly of her. But she said those words, and they were left to stand for too many weeks. And the result was it spread like wildfire in the Middle East and created a real bitterness. And it was a kind of a tone deafness on our part. We've done this before where we, you know, a president will say something or a secretary will say something, and we won't think, how are others hearing what we just said? I quote in the book my mom, who used to tell me that if you want someone to listen to you, you have to hear them first. It's important to recognize the humanity of the other and to know how your words are playing out when they're hearing you.
Thanks, Jack, for your call. Henry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Me?
You.
Oh, the reason why I said you didn't, I couldn't hear your name.
Okay, Henry, hi.
Okay. In the Arab world, the politics is directly tied to the Muslim religion. That is not the case in this country, where politics is separate from the Muslim religion. And so what happens in the Muslim religion directly affects what people think. And there's no way to get around it. The Muslim world is not part of the Western world.
Jim, is that myth or fact, or is there something in there? Thanks, Henry.
It is not myth. I can.
Okay, well, let's let Jim respond.
Let me say a little more.
You might not want to, Henry, but go ahead.
Okay, Henry.
Okay.
Okay.
The non-Western world has not been affected by the Magna Carta. It has not been affected by the Declaration of Independence. It has not been affected by the French Revolution or the thoughts in our Constitution. Now, when things change, then we will see what happens.
Okay. Jim?
Well, I actually have a chapter on that, Henry, and I would recommend you read it in the book. It's called The Frozen Camel. It's about change in the Arab world and change that is both coming and change that has come, rather significant change that's taken place. You're right. They haven't had a Magna Carta. They didn't have the Declaration of Independence, and it's because we had the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence. That's part of our history. But they have had equally significant developments in their history that have contributed to change in their societies. It is important to study each society in its own right and not see it as a function of our history. They will have change, but it will be their change. They'll have reform, but it'll be their reform and not the reform we want them to have. Our polling shows that, and I think also that the history of that region shows that. You go today to the United Arab Emirates and you will see the Silicon Valley play out in front of you in a foreign land. It's where the creative minds are going. It's where the young entrepreneurs who want to make their mark in the world are going, and they're doing brilliant things every day. It's different. It's theirs, but it's real. So I think that you're right. It's a Muslim world largely. We are a Christian world. You may not like it, but the fact is that so much of our culture, so much of our politics is infused with Christian thought that the founding fathers were very clear about that. Religion is a set of ideas. It does not lock people in. It rather gives flavor, though, to the discourse. And the Arab world is changing. The Muslim world is changing. They're changing using Islamic language as we've changed using Christian language. And they're making real progress. You need to go there, see it, read the book. I recommend you read the book. And after you've read the book, which you can order right now online, you can read the book and then comment, write to me. I take any and all questions and any and all challenges. I'd love to have a conversation with you after you've read the book. I think you'd find it useful.
Thank you, Henry, for your call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you'd like, you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page as well. My guest is James Zogby. We're talking about his new book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. And Dwayne, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Dwayne.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
Hi. Hey, I had it. Not necessarily a question, just a statement. I wanted to see what your guys' opinion was. I find as a I'm in my late 30s, 38 years old, and just the way that, you know, I've been raised in society, especially I would say in the last 15 years, I've noticed in my life, speaking from a, you know, Caucasian male Christian conservative's point of view, I just find it ironic that, you know, if a Muslim was say burning, we're gonna burn a Bible, nobody would dare go on the airwaves and speak, call them a nut job. There would be more programming toward. Well, that's their. We would talk about their First Amendment rights to do so, but the minute somebody down in Florida even talks about doing something to a Quran, well, we have this nut job, and I just think that that's so ironic that I feel that we've grown in such a culturally sensitive society that as a white person or a Christian, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut and not say anything. And I just wondered if you guys, you know, how you feel about that, if you have agreed, disagreed.
Well, let me tell you, not only will I tell you that there are nut jobs in the Arab and Muslim world, including religious leaders, imams who have said some pretty repulsive, repugnant, horrible things, but I actually have gone to the Muslim world, spoken to a group there. The U.S. ambassador asked me to do it in 2005. And when they started challenging me about Pat Robertson and people here saying, you know, they're saying horrible things about Islam and what are you doing about that? I said, I'm fighting it every day. I'm right. Fighting bigotry against Islam every day. But you guys have people here who are saying horrible things about Christians and Jews. Are you fighting against that? I challenged them head on that one and actually got some press coverage for it and was proud to do it. The fact is that, you know, look, I'm a Caucasian white guy, too, and a Christian Caucasian white guy, too, a little older than you. I'm 65. But I'm of the age where I believe that we ought to be free enough and smart enough to call everybody's nut jobs, and do our darndest at the same time to change the political discourse so that we actually have less of them and more of folks who can ask the right questions and think more deeply about how do we interact with each other. Burning the Quran is a dumb thing to do. Burning a Bible is a dumb thing to do. Calling Jews and Christians names is dumb, and calling Muslims names is dumb, and we need to isolate that crowd and not give them the coverage that they end up getting, and instead focus on the majority who have, I think, very different attitudes, are much smarter and much more thoughtful, but need to have more attention paid to them. So I'm with you on that, but I think that I just disagree with your initial proposition, but in terms of the rest of it, I think we're on the same page.
Yeah, because I feel like it's always, you know, with any group, it's the worst of the bunch that gets, you know, as a Christian, I have to hear about Westboro Baptist Church, you know, and it's like, that doesn't represent what Christian values are.
Right.
You know,
right.
And the same with,
and
you know,
nor does
Muslims.
That, nor does the nut job in a cave with a beard in Afghanistan represent what the majority of Muslims are all about.
Absolutely.
And I think we need to be clever enough and smart enough to be able to do that, but unfortunately we're not.
Right, as a society we aren't.
Right.
Hey, I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dwayne. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Aisha, thank you for calling, and thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. I love your program.
Thanks.
I was calling because of earlier today, I heard a statement they were saying that a gentleman was saying when he see Muslims, how he get afraid. I am a black African-American Muslim, and I've been Muslim since the age of 16. I am 60 years old of age now. And I would like to say that Islam is a very beautiful, peaceful religion. Muslims normally don't bother people or want trouble with people, just like any other normal person, less than you bother them. Like even in the Middle East, Muslims were not bothering America. America is over in their country. They're not in America. And I think into America, educate themselves and really ask for forgiveness what they have done to black African Americans from the time we came here into this country up into what's going on with Muslims now. Do they educate themselves and forgive what they have done to us and see what the trouble that the world is in today? That God is not pleased. He's not pleased with our white Americans, the things that they have done in this country. And it hurts me so bad for them to walk around acting like they are so righteous and so holy and that they are the perfect people on the planet.
Aisha,
when they are
Aisha,
the people that started all the trouble in the world.
Aisha, let's let James Zogby respond. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Aisha, thank you for the call. And look, there's a lot of pain, and there's pain on all sides. And we have trouble forgiving, and they have trouble forgiving. And I think that the issue here is that if we actually talked and listened to each other, and if we actually heard what each other is saying, we would have an improved environment to move forward. I think, look, on the question of race here in America, we don't listen at all. We sort of get defensive in posture, and when African Americans want to remind us of the legacy of what has happened to them and our history, people tune out. They ought not to tune out. They ought to pay attention. President Obama's marvelous speech in Philadelphia during the campaign is something that ought to be studied by everybody. And I also think his speech in Cairo, in which he talked about the relationship between the West and the Muslim world, and in particular the Arab world, was the same kind of speech. I write about it in the book. It was like the Philadelphia speech. It talked about what we had done to each other and how we don't understand each other and how we need to change that dynamic if we are going to move forward. But assuming, as we have, that we can go into the Arab world and do the things we do without understanding how we're understood, is a big mistake. Look, I remember when troops were marching into Baghdad. I had nephews in Iraq fighting at the time, and I kept thinking, I know what they're thinking, because I'm reading the stuff about what Americans were saying about going into Baghdad. We saw it through the prism of World War II. We were liberating the country, and we were going to free it from the tyranny. If you understood how the Iraqis saw us, they saw us as the new Mongols who were invading and who were the army of conquest taking over their civilization. It's because we didn't know each other. So we didn't understand how each other saw themselves or how they each side saw the other. Very important, I think, for us to change that dynamic. And so what the book tries to do is ask the question, do we listen enough? Do we understand enough? And then through polling data, I tried to show here's what Arabs are really saying about Iraq. Here's what they're really saying about Palestine. Here's what they're really saying about reform and change and what they want. Because if we don't pay attention to what they want and what they're saying and what they believe, then our interaction with them is kind of like, you know, a blind, deaf person trying to communicate. It's very hard if you don't know the other side.
We have to take another break. We'll return to our conversation with James Zogby, talking about his new book, Arab Voices, what they are saying to us and why it matters. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
we can be so closed in. And when you listen to WOSU, they address things from more than one point of view. It's a global point of view, and you realize that you are indeed a citizen of the world and not just a citizen of Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joyce Eubanks, and WOSU is my source for a world view.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of how people with mental illness and psychological disorders are portrayed in movies. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11, right here on WOSU.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
12 degrees currently in downtown Columbus, a few snow flurries today and some sunshine, a high of 19 degrees. But with the wind chill, it'll feel like negative 5. Cloudy skies tonight and a low of 9 degrees, but with the wind chill, of course, it's going to feel like zero. Some sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 22. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is James Zogby, founder and president of the Arab American Institute. He is speaking at the Columbus Council on World Affairs today. The event is sold out, but video of his talk will be posted on the council's website. We'll post that link to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about Jim's new book, Arab Voices, What They Are Saying to Us and Why It Matters. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to, if you have a comment or a question. And you can also email us at allsides@WOSU.org. We were talking during one of the breaks, Jim, going back to the issue just about how we understand each other, and I thought there was an interesting rank of importance of values that we teach our children. Yeah. Neither Arabs nor Americans, the Arab world, in the Arab world, nor Americans value, apparently, tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, how much a part of the problem is that?
I don't think much. Okay. Let me just say the following. I think that the important thing for me about that poll were the top five values that were identical in both. In both societies. The question is, what are the values you teach your children? And the top fives were the same. But then when I looked at the Arab ones, because I sort of did the Arab side first, I looked at them and I said, oh, wow, creativity is at the bottom. Tolerance is at the bottom. That's dangerous. That's going to tell me something. Then I looked at the American numbers. They were identical.
Right.
The top five were the same, and tolerance and creativity were at the bottom. And I guess that, you know, if you take, you know, obedience and cleanliness and respect for elders or whatever, those things are going to be, you know, high up anyway, but down in 12th place is going to be creativity. I think that there are some parents who value teaching creativity first, but I think that there probably are the majority. What the numbers are telling us, anyhow, when we poll Americans, is that they don't put creativity up very high. So it's actually the same in both societies. Creativity and tolerance seem to be afterthoughts in terms of how we bring our kids up. I grew up differently. I think, you know, I hope my kids are bringing up their kids differently. I think they are, but apparently the majority don't do that.
614-292-8513. And Susie, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having James Zogby on. I've admired your work for such a long time.
Well, thank you.
And I wondered if you could talk about Palestine and how Christians, Jews, and Muslims used to get on. And also, I don't think most Americans know what's happening to Palestinians of all faiths these days, Christians and Muslims, and even in Bethlehem. So I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah, thank you. The chapter on Palestine was one of the most difficult to write because I wanted to get it just right. It is two narratives of two people who've been victims, one of whom has now become the victim of the other, and the suffering of Palestinians over the last several decades, is a story that I think most Americans just don't know. You mentioned Bethlehem, and I noted that about a month ago, the Prime Minister in Israel announced that they were going to be building a new, expanding a settlement in what was called Har Homa. The Israelis call it that. It's right now a city of about 15,000 plus people between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. It's actually a hill that is got a huge set of apartment buildings ringing around the hill going all the way up to the top. When I was going to Bethlehem back in the 90s, I worked with Vice President Gore in a project to promote economic development in the West Bank. That was a green hill. It was actually declared off limits by the Israelis as a green area. It was owned by Bethlehemites. It was their land. The Israelis confiscated it, annexed it to Jerusalem, and it was called by the Arabs Jebel Abul Ghneim. They built a settlement on it. They announced they were going to build a settlement. Bill Clinton put his foot down and said, no, you may not. The U.S. got really tough about it. This is Arab-owned land. You have no right to build on it. Today it's got 15,000 people living on it, and they're announcing that they're going to build another 1,000 units there. The Israelis just don't pay attention. And what now happens is that Bethlehem is cut off from Jerusalem by this settlement and other settlements where you can't easily go. If Mary and Joseph were trying to travel to Bethlehem today from Nazareth, they couldn't get there because they wouldn't be able to cross the border and or get through the settlement areas to go to their ancestral home for the baby Jesus to be born. And people just don't know it, that Bethlehem is being strangled by settlements and land confiscations that have stolen the land all around the city and are now building for settlers that do not include Arabs. So it's very hard. But I find increasingly there is a sensitivity to this among churches here in America. There's a group called Churches for Middle East Peace that I do a lot of work with. It's most of the major denominations. They're very active, especially around Christmas time. If you go to Churches for Middle East Peace on the web, you'll find the kinds of work they do. And they're doing their best to educate people mainly in the denominations. The Catholics do the same through the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. It's very important that we pay greater attention. The Christian community was 15% of the population in Palestine. Today it's 1.5. They're leaving because the pressures are just so great and economic hardship is driving them out. It would be an enormous tragedy if we had Palestine with no Christians. It was the birthplace of Jesus, the first Christians were there. And they may be all gone within the next few decades.
Thanks, Susie, for your call. You devoted much of a chapter to U.S. foreign policy toward the Arab region,
yeah,
and listing in all the ways that American presidents and Congress have appeared to side with Israel over Palestine. What are your predictions for the new Congress taking over in January?
Well, unfortunately, the new Congress is going to be trouble. Ileana Ross-Layton, the new chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Congress, has already declared her intention to cut aid, stop aid. She wants to close the Palestinian office in Washington if they don't recognize Israel as a Jewish state, even before the end of peace negotiations. This is a tough crowd, and I think that they will make foreign policy more difficult. When President Obama went to Cairo, I think he gave the right speech at the right time with the right message, but he has had his way blocked ever since then in an effort to implement that speech. He said in the speech, one speech alone won't make change, and it hasn't. And people right now in that region are looking askance at America and at the promise of change that never was delivered. And with this new Congress, I think change will be even more difficult.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Brad, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Did you say Brad?
I sure did.
Ah, thank you. Hello, Mr. Sogby. I respect your work very, very much.
Thank you so much. Did you buy the book?
I have not yet. I didn't even know the book was out.
Well, buy it. Then okay. then you'll show me a direct sign of – I'm kidding.
Arab voices.
I totally agree with your comments. I mean, they're just so obvious that we need more education and tolerance in this country towards the other world's peoples and religion. So I just want your comment on that if it's important for our citizens to have this type of education, how much more important is it for our own military people that interact with the people in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East? How isn't it much more important for them, even more important for them, to be able to interact directly with them from a knowledge base? Therefore, why is our government kicking out people that the military has spent thousands of dollars to train people that speak Arabic and speak the Farsi language, that allows them to know and to be able to listen and to be able to hear what the other people are saying? Why are we kicking those people out? Now, I know why, but it seems to me that if we really want to make progress with the Arab part of the world and the Muslim part of the world, we wouldn't be kicking those people out. So,
if I'm not mistaken, Brad, you're conflating two issues here, and I'm sympathetic to both. I think that you're conflating the don't ask, don't tell with the with this, because many of the folks I've seen who've actually been kicked out or been forced to leave have been gay members of the military who are Arabic language trained and have real sensitivity toward those cultures and are doing their darndest to help the country. I think that don't ask, don't tell ought to be thrown out. I think that we ought to do more to recruit language specialists. And sure as all hell, as you just said, when we get language specialists, we ought to respect them, use their work, and not force them out of the service. So on both counts, I'm with you on this. I also think that, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is a book that was being used by officers in some of the officer training programs called The Arab Mind, a book that was written in the 50s but got reprinted periodically. Last time it was reprinted was 2007. It was used by thousands of U.S. military officers in their training programs. That is a horribly bigoted treatment that reduces the Arab mind to some kind of monolith, that they're all the same, and here's how you understand them, and they understand force, they understand humiliation and shame. And Seymour Hersh, writing in The New Yorker, draws a direct line between the book The Arab Mind and what happened in Abu Ghraib. So on the one hand, we have people who are sensitive and thoughtful. We're getting rid of them. On the other hand, we've got a book that should never have been used that trained people the wrong way. And we ought to end that. I think change is in order on both counts. I also think one other area that troubles me, and that is the elected officials we have who don't know and who speak as if they do know. But that is a practice that politicians seem to specialize in, sounding authoritative about issues they know almost nothing about, and yet getting us in a whole lot of trouble. The debates about the Iraq war, as we were going into that war, listening to members of Congress talk about it, shocking, shocking in what they didn't know, and yet they committed American lives to a war in a country that most of them probably themselves couldn't find on a map. And very disturbing that we don't hold our elected officials accountable for the policies that they make. We elect them time and time again, despite the fact they get us in trouble. And waste lives and resources.
Brad, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. 614. Well, we're actually running out of time, so we'll try to get into the calls that we have waiting. We also have an email from Alex. He said, this morning NPR aired a story on Islamic law in Pakistan, and among other things, they mentioned that it is a crime for a Christian to touch a Quran. I'd never heard of anything like that. Is there a line of thought in Islam that Christians are forbidden to study it? I thought Islam was all about study.
I got my PhD in Islamic studies, and
alrighty,
one of the great Islamic scholars of the world, Ismail Faruqi, taught me I read the Quran inside out many times, so I've never heard of that law.
And you're Christian.
Yeah, yep. Very Christian. I'm Catholic and a practicing Catholic, and I don't know that law, so okay. It was news to me.
Some Americans...
You know, let me tell you something. There are one of the things I think Americans need to understand, that people all over the world need to understand, is that there are little towns in America where Christianity is practiced in ways that most of us would scratch our heads and say, what the heck is that all about? There are varieties of Christian experience here. You've got snake charmers in some parts of the world, some parts of the country, they're Christian. You've got rather subdued Anglican or Episcopal congregations in suburban Philadelphia. You got Quakers. You've got African-American Christians and Catholics of different stripes. The variety of ways of manifesting Christianity are so enormous. It's the same in Islam. So just because somebody says this is the law in Islam, it means in his way of thinking it is. But there is no one Islamic law, just like there's no one way of being Christian. And one of the great books on Islam is by Clifford Geertz, an anthropologist. He called it the Islam Observed. And he looks at Islam in a couple of different places, and he says, each of these is Muslim. Just as I could write a book on Christianity and look at the various kinds of ways Christians act as Christians and say, all of those are Christians. I mean, you had people who used to string up African Americans in the South, say they were doing God's work. They would do it after they would go to church services on Sunday, and they were hanging and punishing the descendants of Ham, who was the cursed son of Noah, punished for his sins because he had laughed at his father, and so he was given the mark to be a slave to his brothers. They were called the Hamitic race. That was a teaching of some Christians. That's not Christianity as I know it. So I think we have to be understanding that Islam has the same kind of variations and the same problems.
We have run out of time. Thanks to James Zogby. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. And I hope folks are interested enough and buy the book. And I'd be happy to take their questions.
The book's Arab Voices, what they are saying to us and why it matters. I hope, Jim, you'll join us again sometime.
Come back.
That's all the time we have. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.